Welcome to the BPL podcast. My name is Josh, and I have a unique episode for you today. The first part is an interview about the upcoming eclipse with two OSU astronomers, and the second part of the episode is an interview with NASA astronaut and former COSI CEO, Kathy Sullivan. It's a space episode. We're doing a space episode. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our astronomers. Dr. Wayne Schlingman is the director of the Ann Saddleback Planetarium and director of undergraduate studies for the OSU Department of Astronomy. And Dr. Stefan Frank was born and raised in the south of Germany, came to America in 2002 to continue a career in physics at the OSU Astronomy Department's graduate program. Earning his PhD from OSU in 2008 and beginning a career in both research and teaching, shifting attention more and more to outreach and communication to the public. Along with Zach, our programming librarian, here's our interview about the eclipse.
A phenomenal question I was asked by a mother of a very inquisitive child this weekend for our alumni events was, these are eclipse glasses. Can you use them to look at the sun on every other day? Or do you have to wait for just the eclipse? And I was like, that is genius.
Yeah, no, it's the funniest part for me. I always point out to people that these are made for exactly that purpose, that you have to be able to look at the sun at all times. And I know a lot of people who actually use them to look at sunspots, because some of them you can spot with your own eyes without a telescope or so, if they are large enough. And so you can always count how many sunspots there are.
There were some this weekend that some of the kids could see.
Yeah.
Now, is there any moment, like if the moon is like completely over the sun, that you're able to just look at it without the glasses, or do you need the glasses the whole time?
So no, at that moment, so you will very readily see that once the moon completely once you're in the zone of totality and the moon covers the sun completely, at that moment with your glasses on, you don't see anything anymore. And that is the moment when you have to take them off. That's when you want to take them off, but only during the totality. If you're outside of the zone of totality, you have to be extremely careful. Even the slightest sliver of the sun that's still there is so bright that it can still do a lot of damage to your eyes. And so outside the zone of totality, please keep them on all the time. But once you're inside of it, that is the moment. And no, you don't want to miss the totality by having glasses on. That's when you have to take them off. But I would also recommend actually practicing this a little bit. Just as Wayne has said, you can use these glasses anytime. And so a couple of days before the eclipse, now you have those glasses, try them out. I always have to fiddle around a lot to get them over my own glasses and things like that. You don't want to do this during the eclipse when everything is hectic or so. Just try them out beforehand and get used to it.
If we lose them, or if we don't have them, or if they're all out by April 7th, what are some other ways that we can experience it without the glasses?
So a good way to watch the eclipse without glasses, or if the weather is terrible, is to go on to NASA TV. They should be broadcasting from a lot of different places along the eclipse path, which means that, fingers crossed, there is some point across the entire path that is actually sunny, and we'll be able to see this. So that's a good place to watch if you can't go outside or something like that. Now, let's just say that you are here in Ohio and it's a clear day and you still don't have glasses. What do you do? Well, we're lucky enough that all of the trees are starting to leaf out a little early, and we will have a bunch of pinhole cameras or pinhole projectors that have been made by the trees naturally. But you can also make one by yourself with a sheet of paper or a big sheet of cardboard or a box. You can make a pinhole projector. And this is really good for kids who may not know that they're not supposed to look at the sun, or they don't know how to do that. So that way, when they're looking at the image of the sun that's being projected, they are not looking toward the sun at all. They're looking away from it. And it's as simple as just a sheet of cardboard with a hole in the middle of it. And it makes a geometric optic that allows you to image the sun. And that is kind of boring on days where the sun is normal and it's just a circle. And then it looks like just a spot on the ground because we don't know or notice that it's different. But on the days where the sun is eclipsed, during the partial eclipse, the sun's shape begins to change. And it looks like a cookie that's being eaten until it starts to reach the crescent sun shape. And then all of the individual images of the sun passing through pinholes will turn into crescents. And so it's a great way to look at the ground, and you can do some art experiments and other fun things like that.
I'm sure to bring my favorite colander, which at that point of time I'm not using for cooking noodles, but for having the sun shine through all of these tiny little holes. And on the ground, lo and behold, you will have hundreds of these little spots that are all looking like Wayne just said, little cookie monsters eating away the sun. So it's pretty cool.
One of our faculty, Jennifer Johnson, gave us the idea that we should hold up these Sloan Digital Sky survey plates.
Ah, yes.
They're big aluminum plates with holes in them that used to hold fibers to take spectra of stars and galaxies. But now we can hold it up and they can be solar eclipse pinholes.
That's actually a cool idea because I have one actually.
Let's say people are able to procure their eclipse glasses. And if they missed out from getting it from the library, there are a lot of manufacturers out there. What are some things that they can look at on the glasses to make sure they're safe? And how can they test them out to make sure eclipse viewing is safe with the glasses that they have?
So one of the things I would do is leverage the resources that have been put out there by both NASA and the American Astronomical Society, the AAS. If you go to eclipse.aas.org, there is a whole page that talks about how to observe this eclipse safely, all the different things you can do. But there's also a big eclipse safety page that lists certified manufacturers and resellers. It's not exhaustive, but it does give you an idea of which people that they vetted as selling reliable glasses. And that's not to say that companies that are not on that list are selling you something that is cheap, or companies that are building them from overseas, that they are less than the equivalent of an American manufacturer. But I don't know. So I was very particular in ordering the glasses we were looking for at Ohio State and making sure that I was getting a reputable vendor, specifically because I don't know. And I can't go through and test every pair of glasses to say these are great and these don't meet it. But for glasses that you have, you do want to make sure, and this is something that you do check, it's at the practice time, make sure that they are not scratched, that when you hold them up to, like, say, a light in your own house, that you can't, but maybe barely see it if it's a really bright LED, and it doesn't look like there's any spots where there's bright light coming through, because that would indicate that the glasses are damaged and you need to not use them.
Yeah, and it's pretty hard to actually see. So when you just inspect them casually, you won't really get the right feeling. So look at something that is supposed to be very, very bright. And if you spot something, don't use those glasses because that is dangerous.
Yeah. Now, some may remember back in 2017, there was a bit of a madness over that solar eclipse that passed through the US. And here in 2024, it seems like it's not as crazy, but we're all preparing. It kind of makes it seem that, you know, these weren't so far apart. It feels like this is a common occurrence. Can you give us a sense of actually how rare solar eclipses are?
So I'll answer a different question first that speaks to why this eclipse is special instead. In 2017, about 10 million people went to go see the eclipse. This one crosses over 31 million people through population centers. So while we may not see that this has gotten crazy, it will be crazier because more people will have the opportunity to see it without even moving.
Yeah, so the rarity. Well, it actually turns out that so let's start the question from a different point of view. When you think about it, the moon is orbiting the Earth. And while we're doing this, we're also orbiting the sun. So you all are familiar with the moon phases. Every month there is the whole cycle of full moon to crescent moon and so on and so forth, back to full moon. And the question therefore is, well, why isn't there a total eclipse of the sun every single month, right? Because the sun and the moon are in the sky, and why? Well, because they need to align, their orbits need to align in such a way, and that only happens about twice a year. And that means that about twice a year on average, there are eclipses. Lunar eclipses are fairly easy to see because all that you need to be able to do is you need to be able to see the moon, because the moon is in the shadow of the Earth. And as soon as you're on the night side of the Earth at that moment, you watch the moon. And it turns out that solar eclipses are also as frequent. However, in that situation, the geometry works a little bit differently, and the shadow that the moon is casting is this tiny little shadow that is running and racing across the whole path of the totality. And as you've seen, that is a very, very, very small strip. well, 70% of the surface of the Earth is water. So most of those eclipses that they happen over water, and naturally very few people, unless you have a boat, will see them. And that means that the rarity of an eclipse at one location is really what makes this so special. So if you are an eclipse hunter, there are people who religiously follow these things, because this is an almost religious experience, as we all have seen and experienced in 2017. There are people who basically ritually they go from eclipse to eclipse, and by chance you can see sometimes two or so per year, but you have to go to these very, very special locations to actually see them, and so that's what makes them so rare in one spot. So yeah, if you are prepared to travel sometimes to really exotic locations, go for it. But once you get them right next to your house, please, by all means, that is special. That is something. Wayne, you said that the next one that we can see from Columbus is, well, beyond our lifetime, right?
Yes. So using specifically the USGS marker that is on campus, the last eclipse that went over that marker was in 1395. And the next one is in 2099.
I'm not banking on that one.
Yeah, not banking on that one either.
Well, you know, with advances in modern day technology, you don't know.
Freeze me and wake me up just for eclipse day.
Medicine, yes. My wife is on that, actually, as a medical doctor. She's working on that.
But so, like, Cleveland gets it this year, and they miss it in 2099. Like, they actually miss that eclipse. It's not by much, but they miss it. And so their next one is 2444. And it's because the eclipse path is wide, and you're going to have eclipses that'll pass over certain areas within nearby. But so they're a little bit more common than you know, 700 years. But at the same point, like at any one spot, it actually is a fairly rare thing to have an eclipse go exactly over you.
Yeah. So my family and I are trying to make a plan for where we're going to see it and all that kind of stuff, where the whole family can go. And I noticed, like, okay, it's going over Delaware, Ohio, like a part of it, you know, but if you go in further, maybe to like Canton, Ohio, or Upper Sandusky, Ohio, or you know, Cleveland or something like that, you're getting more into the center of that shadow that you're talking about that's going over. So what is the difference? You talk about being a religious experience. What's the difference between being on the edge of where the total eclipse is happening and being like right in the center of that shadow?
So the way that I would describe this, and I will let Stefan talk about what it's like to be within totality and going to the center line. But the same question could be asked of, well, if I can stay in Columbus and we get 99.8% totality, why should I go anywhere? And imagine I give you a pair of tickets to the game, and you know that OSU is going to win this year. And these pair of tickets will set you at the 50-yard line, right? You are front and center. You are down there right behind the team. And instead, you stood outside the gate and listened to the game. They're still really cool experiences, but one is significantly different than the other one.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Right? And that's sort of what this is that, and even being on the edge of totality is kind of like, yeah, you got into the game, but you're in C deck versus down on the field. That's the way I would describe it to somebody who really doesn't know what to expect, because it's the same type of phenomenon where it's still cool even at the edges, but it's cooler to be at the center.
Yeah, and so this whole deal with this eclipse path, if you've watched carefully some of those maps, they indicate for how long you will be able to experience totality. And that is basically really what it is. So if you're on the edges of it, you can imagine that the moon moves in a different way there geometrically, and basically frees up the sun again after a much shorter period of time. So once you get closer and closer to the center, the longer and longer you will be able to enjoy these moments. These are very precious moments, because every single second you're staring at the sun that at that moment is completely blocked by the light of by the moon, and you see the corona and all sorts of other phenomena that you only can experience once the sun is totally blocked. For example, we will be very lucky that this time of the year, all five planets that are visible with the naked eye are above the horizon. So therefore, there are lots of things to do while you are in that zone of totality. You want to look at the sun, but you also want to look around and observe all sorts of interesting phenomena, like, for example, being able to see all of the five planets basically at broad daylight. Well, at that moment, it's not broad daylight anymore, and that's the trick. But for that, for all of that, you need time, and therefore trying to maximize the astronomers count it in seconds. Oh yeah, if you're standing on that spot, it's 122 seconds, and on that spot, it's 125 seconds. So that kind of matters. On the other hand, as Wayne just said, that once you're inside the stadium and you're able to watch the game, it becomes a matter of degree of, how big do you want your experience to be? And also, how much money do you want to shell out for some of those tickets? And so my recommendation is also that do not get obsessed with, oh, I must go right to the center. It's fine if you observe it for 2.5 minutes instead of the full 3 or 4 minutes. So as long as you're inside the stadium, so to say, it's going to be a great experience.
Yeah. And the deeper you're in, it's darker. And a lot of it is balancing. Yeah. How far in do you really want to go, and how much, because there's going to be a lot of people moving. And while there has been a lot of modeling about who's going to come into the state and other things like that, the weather forecast, as we all saw from about 2 weeks ago or so, that AccuWeather put out of like, Ohio is going to be clear and everywhere else is not. And I'm like, oh no. Now, that was not a weather forecast. That was a climate forecast of probabilities. But when we start getting close to it, that 3-day forecast, when people start to see, hey, Cleveland will be clear, or Lima might be clear, or, it's going to be cloudy in Ohio, but Indianapolis is going to be a great place to observe it. We're going to see a lot of people make the decision to move. You may not want to do that. And that's going to be a choice that you're going to have to make. But with all of that, I mean, a big thing for all of this is just come prepared, because we are dealing with a lot of people, and a lot of people need to eat, and a lot of people want to drink water. And so bringing stuff with you might be on the road longer than you expected. I know that some people were like, I'll just get my kids as soon as they're done with school, and then we're going to drive into totality. And I'm like, no, you're not. You need to be planning that one way before that. It's not going to be an after school activity. But like planning ahead and doing all of this stuff is going to make that whole experience to where it is that I'm just there to enjoy it, and everything else is as it comes. So that way you're not stressed out about trying to make it back, because you've already planned ahead and everything's good.
So you both, Wayne and Stefan, you recently gave talks here at the library, and thank you for that. If you missed those talks, they are available to view on the Bexley Library YouTube channel. And one of the things that I found fascinating in both that came up in both of your presentations is the science that is done during these eclipses. As astronomers, what are you excited about, and what can still be studied during eclipses today?
Well, so I can speak for the historical part, because that's just the presentation that I gave and will give again, actually, at OSU next Saturday. So one of the great predictions of Albert Einstein when he developed his theory of general relativity was that light is being influenced by large masses like the sun, and it bends around the sun, and therefore stars appear to be in places where they really are not, because the light is bending around, and this light bending was predicted to have a certain amount that was different from the naive calculation, or different from no deflection of the light at all. And that was famously tested in 1919 by a team of English astronomers. And there's a whole fascinating story behind this, and that actually this measurement of the deflection of starlight in the end turned miraculously Albert Einstein into this first superstar of science. And it's a fascinating story. It's also fascinating to see how difficult this really was to measure. The prediction and the derivation in the end is not that complicated, but the actual measurements, especially at 1919, they were breathtakingly difficult. And the stories behind this endeavor are just fascinating. So but that's stuff that this was 100 years in the past. past, and Wayne has a couple of really good examples where we are still using eclipses at the moment, because they're such unique events that also have profound consequences for nature here on Earth, and Wayne can tell you a lot about some of those experiments that are ongoing.
So the sun is really bright, and even in space, if we can block out the sun, it still makes it really hard to find the solar corona and try to study the outer atmosphere of the star that we live around, right? The sun is the closest thing to us, and we still need to know a lot more about it. So during an eclipse, it's the one time that we can really easily study the solar corona. And so one of the things that we will do is use hypersonic jets. So NASA's jets will get into that path of totality and follow along with a bunch of cameras and stuff on the back. So they are imaging and they're staying in there the entire time that the shadow is moving across the ground. So that way they can totally maximize the scientific output of these different things. And they're looking for eruptions on the sun, which we can see usually. We can get big prominences, especially around a solar maximum, which we are approaching. So there's a lot of sunspots, there's a lot of activity on the sun, but then how those eruptions talk to the solar corona. We have to go from thousands of degrees on the surface of the sun to 1,000,000 degrees in the corona. And while we think that it's due to magnetic fields, because astronomers like to just say that word anyway, but it is magnetic fields. But how exactly this energy is transferred from one part of the sun's atmosphere into the other part of the sun's atmosphere, and how they talk to each other is actually really fascinating. It's something that we don't understand well about our sun and other stars. Other things that we can do around the eclipse is that if you think about it, we have daytime, and then in the shadow, it's nighttime, and then we go back to daytime. And so if you want to study the Earth's atmosphere, this is a great chance for you to see exactly what is happening in the ionosphere, which is usually ionized by the sun, and then it recombines at night. But we'll go from daytime to nighttime and back to daytime, and they can make those measurements as it travels across the country, or across the world, in fact. And so we can engage with a bunch of citizen scientists, and we can make a lot of measurements that allow us to understand how our own atmosphere and our own planet work. And this is just some of many different things that people will study about the sun and the Earth during a solar eclipse.
That is fascinating. And again, if you want to take a deeper dive, both of those presentations are available to view on the library's YouTube channel.
Let's get into some fun stuff now. Music to listen to while you watch the eclipse happen. We have 4 minutes, total eclipse. Is that one song, or are you leading up to it with a playlist? What songs are on your playlist for the eclipse?
So during the eclipse, I don't want to have any music or so, because I want to enjoy this as unfiltered as possible, and have that experience. Also, it's fun to, if depending on where you are in what area, it's fun to listen to nature. Nocturnal animals, they get up and they're thinking it's nighttime, let's be active. And to a certain degree, I don't want this to be disturbed by man-made music. However, the whole thing lasts for quite a while, right? So once the moon starts eating up the sun, it'll still take about an hour, and so there is ample time to get yourself a little bit into the mood. And I'm a little bit of an electronic music fan, and so for me, Kraftwerk and things like that, the Space Lab and things like that sounds good. Jean-Michel Jarre, Oxygen is a great album that you can just keep running. You don't have to have a playlist. You just run that for 15 minutes or so, and that's what I like. But yeah, there were a couple of good suggestions: Black Hole Sun and Total Eclipse of the Heart. There are songs that feature eclipses, actually. Pink Floyd is maybe a little bit too morbid sometimes. I mean, the same album, Dark Side of the Moon, also has Brain Damage and songs like that. I'm not so sure, but that gets me in the right mood for a solar eclipse.
I love it. So for me, two songs in working with the eclipse that live in my head rent-free all the time are basically the song of The Sun is a Massive Incandescent Gas from They Might Be Giants. Definitely lives up there all the time.
Nice.
And then along with that is The Sun is Miasma of Incandescent Plasma, which is the updated correct version of the song. But those are same band, and it's just they just live up here all the time. But then, like, when I think about it, it's like Fly Me to the Moon definitely comes up into my brain just on a regular basis. So it's really hard to disentangle what I would like to be listening to versus what my brain is just interjecting into it. But I would also second the whole idea of listening to everything around you, both the reactions to people, because this is going to be an experience that was going to cook some people's noodles. Yep. It's going to be awesome to see people who have never seen anything before. But along with this, I know that because I'm heading to Texas to watch the eclipse because it's equidistant between me and my parents, but not too far from me. And I don't know exactly where, but not too far from me, there is going to be this entire Eclipse Festival that is an EDM festival. And I can only imagine what that's going to be like when you have the sun stage and the moon stage, and then all of a sudden the sky goes dark and these people are just going to be having the time of their life with lasers shooting off into the sky. That seems like a good time to me. So I think it's wonderful to put music to some of this too.
Oh, and I have to plug in. See, I'm also a great heavy metal fan, and Iron Maiden has actually two really great songs. There's their new album, there's Stratego. That song, if you Google that, and if you watch the video, there's a whole story about this. And then their old Gangland album there's a song that's called Total Eclipse. That's a dark version, and it's super great. So yeah.
So I think this will be like hype music for me in the car, maybe driving to the destination. And once we get there, it'll be, you know, cell phones off. And
yeah, well, and as Wayne has actually said, also, you sometimes want to listen and look at what other people's reactions are to this. And this is what I said, is this almost semi-religious experience that, I mean, I'm not sure about you, Wayne, but I'm a relatively hard-nosed scientist, so to say, and in order for me to get really excited, stuff needs to be really extraordinarily good, and usually we are cold-bloodedly analyzing things in nature, and that's my job, and yet I caught myself just weeping at the 2017 eclipse. I my eyes were tearing up. I saw this eclipse, and I'm like, oh my God, this is an amazing experience.
Yeah, I tell audiences in 2017 with my first eclipse, I trained people ahead of time. I told them exactly what to expect. Like, this is the time you should see this. This is when you should look at this. This is all the stuff that's happening. I was woefully unprepared to see this wall of darkness traveling through the sky at me and then have everything go dark and have this giant black eyeball staring at me and seeing all the stars and the shadow bands on the ground before the eclipse started. And like, it was beyond anything my brain was comprehending. And I am looking forward to experiencing that again.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have any parting words of advice or preparation tips or
So one of the things that turned out to be quite interesting for me is because we all so we all have this idea, if you don't take pictures it didn't happen, right? And so that I would say is some of the worst attempts that you can do, because it's very hard to capture good pictures, and so I would usually, and I made the conscious decision during the 2017 eclipse that I did not try to catch any pictures, because they wouldn't do the whole event justice, and I wanted to experience it with my whole body, so to say. But of course, what I did is I mounted my GoPro camera on a tripod and let that run with a wide angle view, because I wanted to also capture the whole situation. We were in a park with a couple of hundred people, and I let that just run for 2 hours or something like that, and I still have that video, and it ran automatically without me doing anything, and that turned out to be actually a nice experience, because sometimes I can now go back to it. I'm like, let's see what was going on there, and that also satisfied this idea that somehow you want to have some photographic evidence or so, but during the eclipse I didn't even touch my phone or anything. I was just staring at the sun, because you can get these pictures from professional photographers that are way better than yours, so don't waste time and effort. Those precious seconds, they keep ticking down, and don't fiddle around with the camera if you don't know what you're doing, especially. I mean, there are people who are specializing in this, and they are really looking forward to it, so I don't want to discourage people doing that, but unless you really have trained yourself to do it, don't waste the time.
Yeah, so I also also made the same conscious decision. And I got one panorama while I was looking at basically sunset in all the directions. And I tried to take pictures of things beforehand because you are going to sit there for an hour or so before the whole eclipse happens. So you have plenty of time to take pictures as things start to get weird.
Make sure your phone is charged.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But as it gets closer to eclipse time, as you've never seen one before, focus on just taking it all in. If you do want a handful of pictures, don't worry about them being good. Because yes, professionals will be taking pictures. You'll be able to relive the moment. But focus on the experience during totality. And then afterward, you can take pictures with all the people you were with, because this is going to be a shared experience for easily 31 million people. But like, there's going to be friends and family that you may not have known for years or not talked to for years that you'll be able to talk to and have this shared experience amongst everybody as they have been across the eclipse path. And it's such a cool thing that it can bring a lot of people together. And it's going to be kind of awesome. But yeah, planning ahead is my advice, is make a plan, stick to it, leave early. Don't try to get home right away because traffic is going to be terrible. If you know of a nice park and you know of a nice parking lot that you want to go to, a million other people are also going to be thinking the same thing. So there's going to be thousands of people filling a lot of parking lots really early, and that's okay. If you can just get into totality and then you can walk someplace and hang out, that's going to be an awesome experience for you, even if you don't make it to where you really wanted to make it. But if you do want that ideal situation, get there early and stay. Just stick with it, and you're not going to be able to outrun this thing if it's cloudy. Yeah. You're not going to be able to get to Cincinnati to Cleveland in the same day.
Which, you know, my parting question is, can either of you personally guarantee a clear day in Central Ohio so that we can all have peace of mind for this?
Well, it depends on how much money you give to me.
Right. So that's a hard thing. The climate forecast for the entire United States in spring, period, is terrible. So the chances of us getting a clear day anywhere in the U.S. is actually really hard for this season. But I do remember reading an article where they showed a bunch of pictures of it's almost equal numbers, and the entire eclipse path is clear except for Texas, as it is clear in Texas, and the entire rest of the eclipse path is cloudy. So like, you're not necessarily gaining a whole lot by going someplace else. It's, you're playing with percentages, and we're up to like 15% better potentially along certain parts of the eclipse path. I was told by NASA Glenn that Lake Erie is going to push back pretty hard on those clouds because of that cold water. So we can hope for that, although it didn't get very cold this year. So, I mean, the water is still cold, but it's not, it didn't freeze. So that's a whole different thing and how much that's going to be able to push back. But I am hoping that whatever we get, it's one of those fast moving things, because you've seen some of this stuff. It'll just rip through and then it's fine. And we could have snow in the morning and it's clear for the eclipse.
Yeah, well, it's all that it needs is 2 minutes of somewhat clarity. The eclipse is still an enormous experience, even if it is somewhat cloudy and you're not going to see all the super spectacular things. It is still something that I in 1999, I witnessed I endured my first eclipse because it was totally rainy, and it was still a very, very bizarre experience that I will never forget in my whole life. So it's even if there are a few clouds or so, don't hesitate to go out and watch it. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
Well, Wayne and Siobhan, thank you so much for giving us your time and talking to us about this. And fingers crossed that we all have a clear and incredible eclipse viewing experience.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
We are honored to have astronaut and author Kathy Sullivan here. She and author and illustrator Michael Rosen just collaborated on a new children's book, How to Space Walk. I'm particularly excited because I'm sure that this book and today's discussion will inspire many of you in the audience to be Bexley's next generation of spacewalkers. Before we get into the introduction, I just want to thank our neighbors and friends, Gramercy Books, for partnering with us to present this great program, along with many others. Bexley Library is truly honored to work with partners like Gramercy, as they help strengthen our efforts to provide you and our community informative programming that's both engaging and inspiring. I am pleased and honored to introduce Kathy Sullivan, dubbed the most vertical woman in the world by Michael Rosen. Ms. Sullivan has spanned the greatest vertical distance of any Earthling, from the deepest ocean to the altitudes of three space missions, among the first women in the U.S. space program and the first American woman to conduct a spacewalk. She's also an oceanographer. That's a lot. She's a global explorer and pilot, as well as author of Handprints on Hubble and the host of the podcast Kathy Sullivan Explores. For several years, she has served as Undersecretary of Commerce for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, for those in the know. She lives here in Ohio with a pair of Havanese pooches. Please help me welcome Kathy Sullivan.
Well, thank you, Ben, for that great introduction. I had hoped to be here with my co-author on the book, Michael Rosen, but he's been having some health issues lately and had to beg off a little bit at the last minute. So he sends his regrets, but expresses great confidence that I could probably keep you sufficiently amused all by myself. So let's see if he's right.
And I will try to help as much as possible in the conversational aspect of it. So what inspired you to write a children's book?
This is actually my second children's book. I wrote one with another local children's book author, Carmela Van Fleet, some years ago, called To the Stars, which is sort of a short version of my career arc and the things that inspired me to end up doing the silly things that I've been doing. And then, you know, Michael and I had known each other for years and talked off and on about doing a book together, but he's a great foil for me because he asks me questions about the technical things I've done that are just straightforward, simple. Explain this in really simple, plain terms to me. And of course, it helps me to see through somebody else's eyes what part of my experiences fascinate them that I might just gloss right by and not even realize are all that interesting. So it was great fun going back and forth with the, well, wait now, tell me about that. Wait, what does that mean? How does that work? And we're actually already working on another one and under contract for another one called How to Dive Deepest.
Oh, that's great. So how does it work? Do you come up with the story? Do you have that outline? Are you collaborative with him as to the story? What's the process?
It's kind of all of the above. We spend a lot of time talking together at the very beginning, sort of agreeing, we think, on the story arc. And in this case, one thing that I hoped we could do, and you all have to tell me if we succeeded, there are three IMAX space movies. Well, there are more than three IMAX space movies, but missions that I took part in figure in three different IMAX space movies. And it always seemed to me the power of all the IMAX space movies was that as an audience, if you felt like you were perched on the astronaut's shoulder, you were with them in the spacecraft, seeing it and sort of experiencing it and doing it through their eyes. And I thought, that's what I would like this book to be like for someone, youngster thinking about a space career or wondering what a spacewalk is like. How do we put that same frame of reference into a book so that you really read it thinking, this is me getting ready to do a spacewalk. What is that really like?
Excellent.
And then once we have that, you know, Michael's a real expert. He's much more fluent than I am, and I think I'm pretty good at it. He's much more fluent than I am at having a sense of, for any given target age range of youngsters, what concepts, what vocabulary, what combination of text per image on a page. It provides the best pace and the best cadence. He's very mindful of the adult that might be reading to them at a very early age. And he's very well connected with a whole lot of publishers that are expert in this market. So he really took care of all of the business and mechanics side of things. And then we'd go back and forth on this storyline and research and text and so forth.
And so would he come up with some illustrations and like, did you get to approve the illustrations before he went all the way down and did the whole book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things we talked about early on. NASA's got a huge trove of images, but I'm old enough that all the imagery of my missions was shot on film in the very olden days when there was such a thing. And not all of those images have been digitized. And even if they were digitized, they're probably not recorded at the kind of resolution that we've all become used to today with digital cameras and cell phone. So we wanted the real images that we used to be those very crisp, wonderful, detailed images, but also to pair that with illustrations that could be both more reflective of me, but also, and again, you all will have to tell us if we judged this correctly or not, kind of thought if all you see in a book like this is pictures of somebody else doing it, does that put a bit of a barrier to you imagining that this could be you as a young child? So if it's an artistic illustration, does that maybe leave the door a bit more open for some imagining of that could be, that's just some figure there that's not specifically Kathy or a real astronaut. That could be me.
Well, that's great. So I guess my question, and we're going to let people ask questions, what was the coolest thing that you experienced when you were in space?
You've got to allow at least two.
Okay, you were allowed two.
Your very first glimpse of the Earth from orbit will absolutely take your breath away. You will never forget that sight, and countless other ones that you see out the window will stick with you forever. So all these people that buy themselves the little joyride space hop, if I could give them advice, I would say forget the somersaults, forget playing with your M&Ms. You've got about 5 or 10 minutes to do this. Stick your nose on the window. That's the life-changing part and the memorable part of the ride that you bought. And the other thing, of course, is how really incredibly much fun it is to live and work in zero gravity. We can have at least twice as many people here if we want to, because we just put the other layer up here at the ceiling.
Oh, and it would have been easier to set the chairs up.
Who needs chairs?
Right, you don't. You just float around. So what was like the strangest thing that struck you as odd when you were in space?
That's a singular for me. It was a moment, so a little bit of backdrop to understand this. A space shuttle goes around the Earth every hour and a half. So you fly through every time zone in an hour and a half. Now, if the sun is over there where that clock is, this side of the Earth is experiencing daylight, and these guys, it's nighttime for these guys. And so you pass from dark to night here, that's sunrise for you, and 45 minutes later, the sun is setting, and 45 minutes later, it rises again. And you're high enough in the shuttle, the Earth is curved, so is your orbit, but you're so much higher that there's a period of time that the ground below you is dark. It's nighttime. The nighttime has hit. And yet the sun, your spacecraft is still in the sun until you get kind of all the way back here. And I was looking out the window at one of those times. We're going to pass from day to night. And there goes the Terminator, as that dark light to dark line is called. And I look down and I see, more and more city lights coming on. And I look at the shuttle, and we're like bathed in bright sunlight. And I realized there could be some little kid down there on the ground right around the twilight hour looking up at the sky and saying, "Look, Mom, it's a satellite," and he'd be pointing at me. And that was a really wild moment.
That seems like a cool moment.
It was a very cool moment.
Yeah.
And I think of that every time I see the International Space Station go over. It's sort of, there go six people. Yeah.
So that's good. Now we all know there's six people in the International Space Station.
Sometimes fewer, sometimes more, but it's there have been at least three human beings living off the Earth continually for 25 years. Wow. So not every human being for the last 25 years, not every human being alive has been living on the planet.
Wow, that's cool. So did you start exploring the ocean before or after you went into space?
Before. I was set academically on a course as an oceanographer. I got my doctoral degree in oceanography. And I did the kind of oceanography that's the geology of the seafloor. How it forms, what the sediments that lay on top of it are, what their age is, things like that. Other people do the biology of the ocean or the chemistry, or the waves and tides, the physics of the ocean. So I was doing the geology. And it comes in two flavors, three flavors in the ocean. One flavor is where different pieces of the ocean are pulling apart, like along the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is an example. Another flavor is where they're pushing together, famously around the edge of the Pacific. And the third flavor is, you know, islands that, like Hawaii, that crop up in the middle. I was specializing in the parts that come apart, but always fascinated also in the bits that come together. So getting in, the chance to get into a small submersible and go see some of that geology, see the volcanoes that you get in these rift valleys, the kind of rift valley you have in Iceland or in East Africa is pretty closely similar to what you have all along the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, like the seam of a baseball right down the middle of the ocean.
So what made you decide then you wanted to go the other direction?
Well, my brother suggested I should give it a try. He was the flying crazy, space crazy kid in the family. And he had already applied either to be a pilot or to be one of the engineers. He didn't care. And he tried to talk me into applying, which I first thought was a stupid idea for an oceanographer. But then I drew the parallel between the space shuttle as a research ship and the research ships I had worked on as an oceanographer. And that made it easier to understand what kind of role I would have if I tried to be one of the engineer scientist types. But the thing that pushed me over the edge was I'd been as fascinated as every little kid in the 60s by all the exploits of the early astronauts. And I particularly had been drawn to every picture they ever took of the Earth, because I was always into maps and geography and things like that. And so if magic happened and you became one of the few out of the thousands that they picked, you'd get to see that with your own eyes and instead of looking at their pictures. This is, you know, think about it. This is, I can show you my vacation pictures of the Grand Canyon, or you can go. Where, you know.
What steps after that? They accepted you, and then you don't just get to go to space after they accept you.
No, here's the horrible secret for all the young people in the world. When you've finished school and you've gone to college and you've gotten a doctoral degree, and then you get a job like astronaut, you end up going back to school. And the first year in astronaut training is kind of like condensed graduate school in every subject that has any significance to spaceflight. So spacecraft engineering, space physiology, biomedicine, geology, meteorology, you know, you name it. So that you've got a broad understanding of the arena that you're working in. And also, so you're in a class of 10 or 15, maybe 30, and everybody's got a different specialty. So you also get a greater appreciation of the expertise of the people you'll be flying with, which you want to know. I mean, if you're a crew together, you want to know if we get into this kind of problem, thank heavens Ben is here because he's really the master of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody should feel safe if I'm on board. So do you have so if you were the age of some of the young folks in the audience here or their parents pushing them to be astronauts, what would you recommend that they start doing now or work on to get into space?
I'd aim my first recommendation at the parents and say, don't push. Let them find the thing that, help them find the thing that will pull them. Because once that switch goes on internally of a passion or an interest, something they're just really hungry to know more and more about, you know, they'll be the best self-propelled. You won't be able to keep up with them at that point. I would say keep exploring things that really interest you, that really fascinate you, that you're eager to know something more about, and find more about it anywhere you can, online or in a library, or ask teachers or parents. They're all actually, even your teachers at school who you think are just trying to make you study are actually very eager to offer anything they might know that could help you find what you want to do. So it's partly about finding something you love and are passionate about. It's getting a sense of what you're, all of us are naturally good at some things, not naturally good at everything. So find those things you feel naturally good at and work a bit hard on the things you're not naturally good at, because you don't know, you can't know really far in advance what mixture of strengths you're going to want in the long haul. So, yes, build on your weaknesses and your passions, but work on your strengths and your passions, but shore up the weaknesses.
Yeah, and go to the library. I think that's
I always loved the library.
That's good. Go to the library and learn. That's good.
I spent hours. I had a couple favorite subjects. I would, in the days when we knew what the Dewey Decimal numbers were, I would go to those numbers on the shelves and sort of randomly pick out a book and sometimes just read a page or two and sometimes take it home, sometimes read all of it. But it meant a lot to be able to go get things that helped me explore what I thought was interesting.
Yep. So this may be an unfair question. Is it cooler to be deep underwater or in space?
They are both very, very cool. I think if you get into, you can't beat the view if you get into space. Mm-hmm. And the view underwater is much shorter because the light that you bring with you can only go, you know, a few feet. But on the other hand, the ocean is alive everywhere. So the life forms you see everywhere through the ocean, no matter how deep, how far from land, that's just endlessly fascinating.
Okay.
How about these guys?
Yeah, what do you think? We got any questions from out in the audience? Thank you, Josh.
Hi. I don't know if you said it before. What was your education before you became an astronaut? Your highest education?
Thank you. It was a PhD in oceanography.
Oh, in oceanography. Okay. Yep.
What's the difference between a lunar EVA suit and a standard spacewalk EVA suit?
Between a lunar EVA suit?
Yeah.
For walking on the moon? That is a really great question. Thanks very much. The biggest difference is that the Apollo suits, the lunar suits in the United States, they were very consciously designed so you could readily walk. So that means, you know, this is walking, right? If you're only going to do a spacewalk in zero gravity, I don't need my hips very much. What I do need is, you know, easier arms, easier hands. So that was the biggest difference. The other difference was the space shuttle suit was completely self-contained. It was never imagined that you would have an umbilical back to the spacecraft. The Apollo suits could go either way because sometimes they did spacewalks while they were on the way, either out to the moon or back. When they did those, they had an umbilical that brought the water and oxygen from the capsule. And when they were doing spacewalks on the moon, they disconnected that so they were free walking. I have tried walking in both suits. It's not easy in either one, but it's wildly easier in the Apollo suit.
What was it like in space?
You know, it's really fun to get to go into space. It's kind of like the world's coolest reward for a lot of your studying and good hard work. You're very busy, especially on a space shuttle mission. There was always a lot to do, and maybe five or six of us splitting the work up and doing it together. So you're working at a big clip. But you got lots of time to glance out the window and see where you were and sightsee and, you know, goof around in zero gravity. It was a lot of fun eating meals. You are allowed to play with your food in zero gravity. That's a rule.
Okay. You want to stand up? Go ahead.
What do you eat in space?
What do you eat? What do you eat in space? You know, some things are everyday Earth things. They're packaged a little different, but... do you know goldfish crackers? Ah, guess what? Goldfish crackers will school in space. You open a bag of goldfish crackers and you pull the bag down. Voila, you have a school of goldfish. They just stay right there. So we would have goldfish crackers and M&Ms and, you know, simple things like that. But usually it would be like camping food where you've carefully pulled all the water out of it. Water's really heavy, so I'd rather pull the water out of it and only carry the light part of the food to space, and then I can add the water back.
What do you do while you're going up into space, like in the rocket ship?
So going up into space in a rocket ship, how long do you think it takes you to get to space in a rocket ship? Ah, very long was that young lady's guess. It takes all of 8 minutes.
Wow.
So your seatbelt is fastened. We don't have tray tables. That's the problem. Your seatbelt is fastened and you've got a helmet on and, you know, some gear to protect you in case something went wrong. And It's a pretty wild ride. You know, Cedar Point has nothing on space shuttles. And you kind of just sitting still. Two of the crew and a space shuttle are always watching instruments to make sure everything's still going well. But in 8.5 minutes, you're there. It takes you about 40 minutes to come home, but it's the same thing. There's a lot of energy involved, like landing in an airliner on steroids. So you stay in your seat.
Okay. What's it like taking off?
It's, again, this is in the space shuttle. It's really loud, even though you're inside the cabin and you've got a helmet on. It's really loud. You have five really big engines going all at once, a couple hundred feet below you. And it shakes a lot for the first 2.5 minutes. And someone's pushing, remember, you're lying on your back. Someone's pushing on the back of your chair. You really feel that. You felt that level of acceleration if your dad ever punched the accelerator coming off a stoplight, or certainly if you've ever done a roller coaster, you felt that same acceleration. But it comes from your chest and pushes you back in your seat. After about 2 minutes, the shaking stops, and those two engines fall away, but you're still being pushed faster and faster until you get to the right speed for your orbit.
Hi, thank you for being here. It's so cool that you're here. If you're an author, you must be a fan of stories also. So I'm wondering, are you a fan of science fiction? And if you are, which ones you like? And like, do you feel that any of them like actually connect to a true experience? Or are you so tired of it that you don't like to watch it at all? Like,
I'm a huge avid reader, but I was never a wildly crazy sci-fi reader. I like Douglas Adams' The Tiger Guide to the Galaxy, because who doesn't? I like David Brin's stuff. My favorite right now probably is Ted Chiang, who did, The Story of Your Life, which became the movie Arrival. His short stories they're just vastly more thoughtful than most sci-fi writers, so I like those a lot.
What is the best part of floating in space?
What is the best?
Of floating in space.
The best part of floating in space? Oh, it is so cool. I made a habit of always eating my dinner upside down, just because I could. And you'll find your vocabulary changes. We know, here on Earth, we know it's polite to say, please pass me the salt, or please pass me the so-and-so. You start to say, please send me. So if you wanted this bottle of water, I would just give it a little push and it would drift over to you. So there are all sorts of, if you want to declare, these squares on this wall, you could declare them to be the squares of your sidewalk and walk, or pretend to kind of walk back and forth. So it's fun to let your brain play with things and turn the room upside down.
Wow. What did you do for exercise as far as maintaining muscle mass, bone health?
Thanks. The longer you're going to stay in zero gravity, the more important it is to work on both bone strength and muscle strength. And when I was flying, we had just a simple treadmill and bungee cords to keep you on it so that when you took a step, you didn't just float to the ceiling. It turns out that was not doing a great job of really conditioning the muscles, and it really wasn't doing anything for bone strength. So the space station teams have evolved much better modes of resistive, a better treadmill and other modes of resistive exercise to get at both muscles and bone.
How is a submarine made?
What's a submarine? How is it made?
How is it made?
Oh, that's a great question. If you want to go really, really deep, you make your submarine as a ball, and you make it with a very thick wall of metal so that it's getting squeezed the same amount from every direction as you go deeper and deeper. So that's the way you do it. Then you need to put some flotation on it, so when you're ready to come up to the surface, it just comes back on up. Great question.
That's so cool.
So how long were you in space?
I flew in space 3 different times. 7 days the first time, 5 days the second, and 10 the third.
Was it hard to train to be an astronaut?
Hard to train. It was more, There were some things that were physically demanding. The spacesuit, you got to get used to working in the spacesuit. It will build up some strength, especially in your arms. It's got a lot of hard parts on it. It's a hard shell around your shoulders. So you get used to being bruised a little bit, and you're always reaching as hard as you can, so you tend to bruise your fingers a bit. Sometimes you had to do things like practice bailout drills and things like that. That would take some exercise. But what we really, the hard part was always the pace of the training, trying to train in a fixed period of time with so many things to learn. So the biggest hurdle of the training was really the mind, the intellectual training, and all mastering all the things, that you had to and that your trainers were checking off, but B, that you wanted to, because you really want to do your job well as an astronaut. Other people, we didn't fly to do the things that we had chosen that we wanted to do. There was a scientific team that might have worked for 10 years to get ready to have their experiment flighted. I was going to operate it for them. So a lot of people had put their career in your hands. And you know, when you're looking for people to be astronauts, you're looking for people who will care about that and really invest in doing a good job.
Did you do the moonwalk on space?
I do a moonwalk. The shuttle couldn't go to the moon. It was designed just to go around the Earth. And really, it was designed to be like a ferry that went back and forth from the Earth to a space station. It took a while after the shuttle was flying to get the space station actually there. It had to be built piece by piece. So you need an entirely different design of a rocket to go as far away as the moon. And NASA has built one now. They flew a test flight a couple of months ago, and they've got a crew of four people that's going to go out and around the moon and back, maybe yet sometimes this year or possibly next year.
How much space do you have in the spacesuit?
How much space do you have in the spacesuit? Exactly as much as your body. It's basically a body-shaped spacesuit. So you look like a Michelin man, but there's no pockets or storage inside the spacesuit.
Were you scared when you went into space?
You know, I wasn't. But astronauts always worried they might mess up and, you know, not do their job right or make a mistake. And we know there's a lot of risk, you know, to flying into space and back. But we understood those risks. We got to inspect and check a lot of pieces that could be risky. And we knew pretty well all the people who were working on our behalf to make sure that things were safe. So at some point, you've got to trust that you're part of a team that's really doing good work, and then just go ahead.
What was the hardest thing you've done in space?
What was the hardest thing about going in space? Yeah, on two of my flights, we had about a dozen different experiments, all really interesting, but very complex and complex machinery to operate. So, you know, learning all those details of how do you operate this, and also learning what the scientists were, what are they really trying to get? What are they really trying to do? So that, you know, if we ever lost communication or if we had something unexpected come up, I could really be sort of instinctive on what's the best thing to do for their interest, not just call them and say, you know, oops, now what? So you're trying to be an active part of making things go right, not just taking instructions.
Talking to the mic. Okay.
What's your favorite sea creature you saw?
Your favorite what?
Sea creature.
Oh, sea creature.
The coolest sea creature I saw? When I did my deep, 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 deep dive, we dropped three robot packages down as well. And one of them, when it came down, seemed like it woke up a neat little worm that was living in the mud. And that little guy was probably about this long and maybe about that wide. Was, you know, you could see right through him. And he had little tendrils, tiny little tendrils that wiggled all around his body. And he swam like this with his whole body undulating. And we had this camera on the robot package. This little guy was kind enough to swim right up through our whole camera view so we could watch him the whole way up. I don't know his name.
Can you breathe in space?
Can you breathe in space? Inside the spaceship, You can breathe just like you do here because we have the same amount and the same kind of atmosphere that we have here. And inside the spacesuit, you can breathe. Again, we've got the kind of atmosphere you need. It's a little more oxygen, but it works. But outside in space, there is no air to breathe. So nobody can breathe.
What was your favorite meal to eat in space?
Ah, you're not going to believe what my answer is. My favorite meal to eat in space was shrimp cocktail. And it was dehydrated. So it looked really funny when you first opened it up. And you inject some water into it and sort of massage it around. It tasted good. But the other thing that was fun is you could take a shrimp out. Remember, this is zero gravity. You could take a shrimp out and you could start it spinning a little bit. And we had satellites that when we launched them from the shuttle, we launched them by getting them to spin. And so we had fun, and that's called spin stabilized. That's like a toy top. And so we would sit around in the cabin with our shrimp cocktail and start doing spin stabilized shrimp. And then we could just go and eat it right out of the air. M&Ms are also very, very fun. But they're not really a meal. Well, they can be, but.
Do you believe that there's life outside of Earth?
I believe there's life outside of Earth. I'm pretty sure there is. Now, it's not probably going to have two or three or four legs or business cards or, you know, cars that it drives. It's probably a microbial or an algae of some sort, which, if you think about it, isn't very strange at all, because the bulk of life on this planet by mass is microbes and algae. You know, we think we're the be all and end all of life on this earth, but without microbes and algae, there ain't no us.
What was your reaction to the shuttle disasters?
I think every astronaut's reaction was huge sadness, because we knew all those people. We knew their families. We lived in the same neighborhood with them. So that was a lot. A blow of disappointment, because as I said before, we knew the other engineers and teams that were responsible for parts of the shuttle, and clearly one of those had messed up big time. So when you discover you've been trusting somebody a lot, and they let you down like that, that's what you start investigating, whether they let you down just by accident, some inadvertent thing, inadvertently overlooked, or you're also, you know, mind mistakes. Like, you should have thought of that. There's kind of, you can't really excuse that you didn't catch that you didn't think about that. And there were elements of that. There were elements of that in both the Challenger accident and the Columbia accident that were, someone really should have caught that. The person sitting in that seat should have asked another question, should have pushed a little harder. So that's another disappointment. But I think the other thing behind both of those, or on top of both of those, that we all thought about is there. You knew this could happen at some point. It's really very unfortunate, very sad to lose people. But the purpose that an outfit like NASA is pursuing on behalf of a country, it's not the same scale as asking people to go into combat because of a war. But it's also not asking people to work hard just to take a fun ride. And so that purpose, all of us still believed in. And so we also wanted to make sure that we got back into flying again. Figure out what happened, learn where mistakes were made, figure out how to correct them, and then let's go fly again.
I have like two questions. The first one is, I'm assuming that as an oceanographer, you also were a scuba diver before going to space, or no?
I got scuba certified when I became an astronaut in order to train for spacewalks.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you did just like zero buoyancy, or if you'd ever done like the Key West lab or anything that are like the longer term scuba kind of missions. And then my other question was, what mission or experiment has happened since you left the program that you're like, man, I really wish I could have participated in that one?
So the answer to your second question is pretty well every shuttle flight that has happened since I, and sign me up for Artemis too. I'm ready to go. So the habitat that NASA now uses, underwater habitat, to put crews in as sort of a simulation or a proxy for a close environment, working together. You can't just open the door and walk out. You have to take some care with getting out of the habitat and into the habitat. That That had been retired and was not in service when I was flying actively. Something actually I can help make happen when I was chief scientist at NOAA was to get it back in the water. So it was working again. So once again, I'm too old to have done those missions.
What was your favorite planet?
Oh, my favorite planet is definitely this one. My second favorite planet is Mars, because it has really big, really cool volcanoes.
You being both a scientist and an author, I was wondering, and a children's author, I was wondering if there was a book as a child that really sparked your imagination and inspired you to pursue such an adventurous life and career.
Oh, there were many of them. And if you think I can remember the titles of any of them. there were, you know, my parents read us all the standard little kids' books, The Little Train That Could and so forth and so on. I think, you know, my mother was a great inspiration about, she inspired me particularly to keep, you know, be you, dream your dreams. And neither of our parents either edited us, you know, girls don't do that or boys don't do that. So we had, you know, free rein permission to explore whatever we wanted to explore. I started reading young people's biographies at a very early age of anybody who had explored or had a more adventurous life than I had. James Michener's Caravans, which I think I read in maybe sixth grade, showed me, gosh, this Foreign Service thing has got this interesting exotic dimension to it. Maybe that's the path. But I, you know, I didn't settle on I want to study X until I was in high school and chose languages and then discovered the sciences in college and changed. And even then, I didn't say because I want to be a so-and-so. It was still just... This seems something that will open up a fascinating range of opportunities for me to choose from if I get some experience in it, if I get some study it to a professional level.
Were you cold when you went into space?
Oh, great question. Was I cold when I went into space? You know, the space shuttle, like the space station, it's got radiators and coolers. It's got, you know, lots of sun right outside that's going to keep trying to make the inside very, very hot. And a lot of people inside will make it hot. And there's actually a thermostat dial that you can turn to make the system, just like your house, make the system bring you more heat or bring you more cool. You've got the same thing in a spacesuit. There's a little dial on the front of the spacesuit. It's easy to get very, very cold in a spacesuit because the deep space is minus 255 degrees Fahrenheit. So when you go out in a spacesuit, it's like it's as if you're sitting on a block of ice that's 255 degrees cold. It's trying to pull all the heat out of you. And it's actually hard. It's really hard to work hard enough in that spacesuit to generate enough body heat to counteract that. So you have to watch out to not get very cold in the spacesuit. You guys have had great questions. Do we have another one?
Just one more, if you would humor me, please.
Sure.
Okay. Have you ever seen a sea monster?
I ever seen a sea monster? You know, I have a couple ugly dive partners, but no, I haven't. I've seen, there are some pretty funky looking creatures in the deep sea, but the ones you see in books that look really, really funky, like with big teeth and things that hang out like this, are actually all about this big. So they kind of look, they're kind of monstrously ugly, but they're ridiculously small.
Thank you for tuning into the BPL podcast today. I hope you enjoyed. To find out more about the Bexley Public Library, including upcoming events, visit our website, bexleylibrary.org, or the handle at Bexley Library across all major social media platforms. Special thanks to FOMO Deep for lending us their song Bourbon Neat for the podcast. Please check out all of their music at FOMODeep.com. Email me with any comments, questions, or suggestions at podcast@bexleylibrary.org. Thank you.